50. That's 212-209-2950. Or you can go to the WBAI website. That's WBAI.org and click Buddy. So you can become a Buddy. That's a monthly sustainer. $15 a month, $10 a month, $25 a month. Or you could make a one-shot contribution to WBAI to help keep it alive. It's independent radio. Independent media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. So go to WBAI.org or call 212-209-2950. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Good morning once again, and thank you so much for tuning in. It's 9 a.m. here in New York, and coming up at 10 will be Code Pink Radio. But right now at 9 a.m., please stay tuned for Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg.
Peter Tosh, thank you. Thank you for that sentiment. No, there can't be peace without equal rights and justice. I'm Mimi Rosenberg, and this is Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate and agitate and organize to empower we the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones who can make it so. To empower us with information, not propaganda, about the latest genocide. In fact, the rolling Holocaust and second Nakba, Arabic word for catastrophe, against the Palestinian nation. For us to become even more attentive and consistent and better allies. For a free, free Palestine. Later in the program, Professor Stephen Zunis, an American international relations scholar specializing in the Middle East politics, talks about Biden's backing of Israel war crimes and ongoing tradition carrying a sordid U.S. history. But first, we speak with Abba Solomon, author of The Miasma of Unity, Jews and Israel, to discuss how pro-Israel Jewish organizations had recognized the dangers of Zionism and how right they were. Abba, thank you for joining us early, early your time, but I'm not terribly sympathetic, even though we're waking you up in Seattle since you just returned from a splendid, I dare say, vacation in Hawaii.
Thank you, Mimi. I'm glad to be here.
And I mentioned,
actually, my plane was late, so I'm actually somewhat short of sleep.
Oh, dear. Well, some apologies there. But, you know, I mentioned Hawaii because I just want to since when I contacted you there, and I thought it was pertinent to the discussion that we are about to have on really the issue of Zionism, a particular form of settler colonialism, that you mentioned something about as I was drooling over the idea of your being, as we were in the middle of a snowstorm here, Hawaii. And I wonder if you could just give me a quick synopsis of some of your comment about being in Hawaii and the reality of colonialism there. And I think it helps inform what will be our discussion. Yep, it will, on Palestine and the nature of Zionism.
Yes, well, just the fact that Hawaii, our 50th state, is also a extinguished independent nation. The Kingdom of Hawaii was quite an advanced mid-Pacific country. The Iolani Palace had electrical wiring before the White House did. It had newspapers and literacy in the Hawaiian language, and it was quite the functional kingdom. It made the mistake of it was open to foreigners to come and join Hawaiian life. People of with skills from the United States and Britain and other places became part of the government of Hawaii, because the kingdom allowed foreigners to become part of the polity there, on a basis of equality. Queen Liliuokalani, who was deposed by an American coup supported by American Marines, said that we were capable of everything. We were capable of running a modern state. The one mistake we made was trusting you. she was speaking about the American advisors and cabinet members who she assumed would act with a certain honor, but mid 1890s, an American coup was performed. A republic was created that favored the English language and that did not allow for universal suffrage, and that suppressed basically Hawaiian culture, took over. And then a few years later, in a quite suspicious move, became an American territory. This had to do with sugarcane and pineapple growing concerns that wanted tariff-free access to the United States market. The United States wanted a military base in the mid-Pacific for refueling and for its ambitions to have a Pacific military presence. So it's a very shabby and tragic situation. There are remaining Hawaiian, there's efforts to revitalize Hawaiian culture and language. But the situation is basically that Hawaiians who are of Hawaiian ethnic origin are a small minority now and are basically quite underprivileged.
Well, thank you for that very brief synopsis. I used to wear a button that I should unearth that said U.S. out of everywhere. The U.S. imperial hegemonistic interests have been so destructive and exploitative to the world's peoples, and certainly is replicated through our relationship to Zionism and to the support militarily and diplomatically for Israel. But we're going to dive into something that I think is very significant, which you've spent a good deal of time researching. And that is, I opened by saying pro-Israel Jewish organizations had recognized the dangers of Zionism, and they were right. So we're going to talk about your understanding of what Zionism is, what those Jewish organizations and when were objecting to, and how it has since come to fruition, the destructive character, which in my mind is a component part or a particularly unique form of settler colonialism, and settler colonialism inherent to its nature equals genocide. That's a lot to unpackage, and I want to begin. And I just want to contextualize that by saying, which you and I had briefly discussed, Abba, and that is I was really distraught to receive information that the union, for example, that I'm in, which is the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys Local 2325 of the United Automobile Workers, had its membership, its rank and file membership, had composed, had drafted a resolution for a ceasefire, and were seeking a vote of the total membership as to whether or not to support it. We were actually sued to try to prevent that resolution from being put forward to its membership, by and large seeking a ceasefire for the genocide that is unfolding in Gaza. Now, I say that because it was followed up, which causes great apprehension, by the House Committee on Labor and Education, actually not a subpoena, but otherwise using its heft as a congressional entity to demand, to essentially dox our union, to demand documentation and information relevant to the construction of, the creation of, and advocacy for that resolution. Absolutely, yes, outrageous. But, you know, we're going to get into that a little bit later, because I'm just trying to set the stage for the incredible witch hunt, McCarthyism, the new McCarthyism that is taking place, and largely under this canard of anti-Semitism for anybody who is an advocate for the Palestinian people. But I want to roll it back to that initial question, but which is the issue of Zionism. How do you understand Zionism, and what were the considerations of Jewish organizations that this support of Zionism would have a negative effect on Jews and the entire Middle East area?
Yes. Well, American Jewish Committee, which is where I did most of my research, which is the largest umbrella organization, Jewish organization in the United States, had two kinds of concerns about Zionism. One was the practical question of the fact that Palestine had a small number of Jews living there 100 years ago or 120 years ago. There was some small colonization efforts, but it was perfectly clear that an entire people was living there, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and the idea of taking it over for a Jewish state, if maximal political goals were sought, would lead to trouble. I mean, that was simply clear. But the other part of the question was what Zionists were proposing as the essential truth of Jewish life, which was an entirely defensive view that Jews are always eventually going to be unwelcome and suppressed, and that they don't really belong wherever they live, America, or there was a good Indian community all across the Middle East, Damascus, Tehran, Cairo, Beirut. In other words, we were a worldwide ethno-religious group. And the definition that Zionists were proposing based on the Eastern European model was Herzl's formulation, which is, he said in the Der Judenstaat, the Zionist manifesto, basically, we naturally move to those places where we are not persecuted, and there our presence produces persecution. And he talked about the unfortunate Jews are now carrying the seeds of anti-Semitism into England. They have already introduced it into America. Now, he's talking about Jewish immigrants to Great Britain and the United States. He concludes that passage, the longer anti-Semitism lies in abeyance, the more fiercely it will break out. And I think this is important to understand. The worldview of Zionism is a despair that Jews have a future around the world. And Zionism, as a matter of fact, through Zionist efforts of various sorts, a number of Jewish communities don't exist anymore that did, especially around the Middle East and in the Arab world, that did have quite successful centuries and thousands of years long lives building community. And those have all been wiped out because of this view and this assumption that Jewish life doesn't have a security or a legitimacy outside of the state of Israel. And that really, the point or the slogan of Zionist settlement in Palestine was negate the diaspora, negate the galut. So the entire 2,000 years of development of Jewish life around the world and of enriching our learning and philosophy was to be thought of as valueless. So that we could resume this continuation of our national life back in Palestine. You can see now that actually they have people in the government who want to rebuild a temple and have animal sacrifices and have priests in the old way to resume a genuine Jewish life that they envision now that they're back home. And this assumption of being inevitably oppressed, that's the story of Jewish life for the last few thousand years since leaving Judea, is they felt poisonous. The American Jewish Committee, their entire focus was to help new Jewish immigrants and old Jewish Americans have equal rights and participation in the country, and also to work as a protective force for Jews abroad who were in experiencing oppression.
If I may, one of the things that seems to me to be strategic to the issue of Zionism and uncoupling Zionism from Judaism is the, I think, politically opportunist construct that the Jews are a nation based on a kind of biblical fable, if you will, but that they are a nation versus Judaism, which is a religion, albeit that it was a religion that became very diasporic for various reasons. And so I wonder if you can address that and then take us to this issue of, so there's this defensive posture. But certainly, yes, your premise is that Zionism is actually, in the final analysis, both destructive to the fundamental cultural tenets of Judaism and its moral sensitivities, as well as, of course, becomes a settler colonialist movement that has been, yes, at war, at certainly since the creation, although before, but certainly since the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. So those two issues, if you will.
Yes, it's a regressive sort of philosophy in the sense that it is one of the tenets is that people who are not Jewish are essentially ultimately dangerous to us, so that we cannot fully trust them, that we should expect mistreatment, and we should expect to be turned upon, which is kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy if you're going to, at times, depending on, you know, if you're going to think about anybody outside of the group as being potential murderers of you. That's one problem that they saw. The other is that it's ahistorical. Jewish life is not just a series of oppressions. It's a series of also successes and cultural development. So it diminishes value of being Jewish into just being cannon fodder, or being a guardian of this particular piece of land and fighting other people for it.
Hmm. Talk about how, for example, voices like Jabotinsky, who was one of the seminal voices for Zionism, laid it out, and what we are to do with that, and how continue to talk about how Zionism has become a terrifying danger. And then we're going to head to debunking the idea that it is anti-Semitic if one opposes the state action of Israel or one opposes the nature of Zionism, a settler colonialist doctrine and activity of the Israeli state. So help us understand further the issues of Zionism as settler colonialism, which was inevitably to clash with the indigenous population of, yes, the historic land of Palestine.
Yes. Professor Rand Greenstein, who works and teaches in South Africa, he's an Israeli, he has done an analysis, and he talks about the idea of settler colonialism as a model for what Israel is. And he says, just because of some details, that it's its own sort of settler colonialism, just an aside. But the premise of that the outside world basically is dangerous to Jews, and there must be this retreat to a defensible place of our own, excuses basically what Jabotinsky and other Zionist theoreticians laid out, which was, we must do this because we are in so we are so uniquely targeted by the world that we are entitled to take this. And we know that there's going to be a struggle, but we feel entitled that, well, Arabs are kind of interchangeable. They can go somewhere else. There's other Arab places, that the fact that they live there doesn't outrank the need for creating this solution for Jews. So almost anything becomes permissible in terms of injuries or violence against to make Arabs move, as we saw in 48, and as we're seeing now with this relentless settlement of what was left of Palestine after the 48 war, now, you know, filling and dividing up the West Bank for more Jewish settlement. There's the feeling that this, that there's no moral compunction, because the overriding need for this, to fulfill this philosophy, nothing should get in the way, practically speaking, including any kind of dishonesty. I mean, there's this quote I found in 1953 of the Israeli Council in New York, saying this was a miraculous settlement that the state of Israel achieved because we didn't displace anybody. I mean, nobody could have believed that. It was very well known that, you know, 700,000, 750,000 perhaps, refugees were in camps surrounding the new state who had to leave their homes and villages within what was now Israel. But I'm just astounded at how much misinformation the state of Israel and Zionist advocates are willing to present. The education of Jewish youth is filled with that sort of nonsense, that this was that Arabs are just being cranky because they don't like Jews, and that hostility from Palestinians is anti-Semitic, which is crazy.
Well, you've even suggested, and I would agree, that Zionism really created what you've alluded to as death camps and death camp positions and conditions. And that's how I see certainly Gaza. And frankly, I see the occupation of the West Bank as similarly situated. So, I mean, is that too dramatic to suggest that Zionism is actually antithetical to some of the moral tenets, whether you were of cultural descent as a Jew, or whether you secular, that is, or whether or not you are a religious Jew? It would seem to me that Zionism is actually anathema to some of the teachings, the moral teachings of Judaism.
Well, certainly. Leo Strauss, the philosopher, 50 years ago was giving a lecture, and he talked about a early Zionist tract by Leon Pinsker, who wrote a manifesto called Auto-Emancipation. Same concept as the Judenstaat, the idea of a Jewish state solving problems of oppressed Jews of Eastern Europe. And the philosopher Leo Strauss says that the manifesto quotes the classic Hillel statement, a contemporary of Jesus, by the way, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? And if I am not for others, what am I? And if not now, when? And Strauss points out that Pinsker quotes the first sentence, if I am not for myself, who will be for me? But he leaves out the second part of that saying, which is, if I am only for myself, what am I? And he says, the omission of those words is the definition of pure-blooded political Zionism. It is a single-mindedness that, to one idea that seems to override every moral question, certainly the treatment for the last 75 years of Palestinians, and this, I think, death camp conditions is perfectly legitimate to say 2 million people are now experiencing in the last 4 months in Gaza. And we haven't seen the end of it. The suffering is just going on. And every sort of deprivation that happened to Jews and others in the Holocaust is happening to people imprisoned in Gaza. The hunger, the disease, the violence, the indifference to their lives, to an unimaginable number of people at an incredible rate of speed now.
So would you agree that Zionism is settler colonialism? Settler colonialism equals genocide, invariably, inevitably, as it seeks to either displace, i.e., that it ethnically cleanses those people of another persuasion or nationality and so on that it cannot absorb or will not be subject to its cultural control or agree to live in an apartheid life, so that it invariably it either ethnically cleanses those people that it cannot control, cannot harness, that it will extinguish their very lives. That it is indeed a genocidal philosophy that has become a movement and is the dominant doctrinal ideology of the state of Israel.
Well, I have to admit, to me, it also is a dead end for Jewish culture and Jewish life. And that was the concern of American Jewish organizations, that they thought this fanaticism was also destructive of long-term growth and adaptation of Jews in the world. I suppose what I'm saying is that it is based on irrational an adoption of an irrational stance, and it has to become more and more cruel. There's a saying, I think, attributed to Voltaire, that if you can make somebody believe absurdities, you can make them commit atrocities. And I think that's where we are, because they just keep on hammering away at trying to make a very skewed view of the world work by more and more armed force and suppression.
You know, one of the other things as time marches on that you started by mentioning earlier, the American Jewish Committee, Congress. But one of the things that we've also talked about now is that they, similarly to what I had mentioned with a number of groups at the beginning, that they've actually proclaimed that Jewish Voice for Peace, for example, is a front for Arabs, that we yes. have had the occupation, if you will, of the American mind, a tremendously important film that was done, which you participated in, that was looking at how the Israeli lobby and Zionist ideology has, as a propaganda tool, really corrupted our sense of or try to absorb and corrupt, I think, any form of Jewish morality that may have been baked into some of the initial tenets of Jewish thought. But I want you to talk about how Zionism is now additionally a tool for a terrible propaganda witch hunt to paint anybody who is oppositional to the Israeli state and to Zionism ideologically and in its practice as destructive, how it paints them as anti-Semitic. And
right.
is trying,
and
which is ironic because I consider it to be anti-Semitic to lump all Jews together as if you don't support the state of Israel's policies, therefore you are inherently anti-Jewish in your sensitivities, anti-Semitic. So
right.
unpackage some of that for us because it's terrifying and it's horrifying. And we are engaging in a ferocious witch hunt to silence and chill speech that is in empathy with and supportive of Palestine and Palestine as a nation.
Right. And it's targeting a lot of dissident Jews, interestingly enough, for which is ironic. There is the federal government, the Department of Education is now investigating a number of universities on the premise that because they permitted vigorous pro-Palestinian rights demonstrations, that this was that this is a unfriendly atmosphere for Jews. The idea being that if you're against Israeli actions and you're Jewish, that you're somehow being oppressed if there's dissent about American support for Israeli actions. I was a member of a website called Democratic Underground, and I made one post. And I was banished because I said that the Anti-Defamation League has become a Zionist organization. Mm-hmm. And that just that little bit of fact caused me to be banished from a democratic progressive website. There's just a lot of willingness to suppress things that just in any way can question compulsory Zionism and compulsory American alignment with the goals of the state of Israel. You see President Biden saying that Israel is necessary because no Jews can be safe without it, which is an extraordinary adoption of the Zionist view of the world. And also privileges Jews as having the most experience of suppression and of injustice that no one else has ever had or never does, never experiences, which is crazy. If you look at the scope of history and the number of people who have been murdered by colonial actions and persecution of minorities, it's just, this is a full court press on the part of the federal government and a number of Jewish organizations and donors. You see the pressure that Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania were put on simply for allowing Palestinian protests.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have to continue this discussion and dig deeper, but to inform ourselves so we can ask even more probative questions. And we want people to seriously do more reading. And I would recommend strongly The Miasma of Unity, Jews and Israel, to discuss how pro-Israel Jews and Jewish organizations had recognized the dangers of Zionism and how right they were. And Abba, I want to thank you for imparting some of your great knowledge to us, getting up early, extra early to do so. And sorry that you're a bit jet-lagged as well, so you got even less sleep from your return. And thank you for that little anecdote on U.S. imperial hegemony and U.S. destructive relationships with the world's communities, no less so in Hawaii. You're a pleasure to have on and continue to do the work that you do as we do what? Well, we fight for a ceasefire most immediately and most definitively for self-determination for the Palestinian people. Thank you so much, Abba Solomon, for joining us.
Thank you, Mimi.
Isaiah 2:4 says, "And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people, and they shall beat their swords in the plowshares, and their spears in the pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore."
Immediately, Ayanna Gregory is saying it for us. Ceasefire, that's an immediate message. Ceasefire now, stop the funding. U.S., stop the diplomatic support, stop the funding of the Israeli genocide. We have blood on our hands. We are funding it and have been since World War II to the point of $3.8 billion every single year, not to mention the additional monies that we are now asking for. Well, I am delighted to have on from, and by the way, ceasefire, certainly self-determination, a critical element. Stephen Zunis is with us now, an American international relations scholar specializing in Middle Eastern politics, U.S. foreign policy, and strategic nonviolent action. Zunis has stated that Israel's government engages in a pattern of gross and systemic human rights violations and blatantly violates a series of UN security resolutions and other international legal principles. Well, we want to continue to talk with Professor Zunis, or begin our discussion, really, which I think is maybe we begin by understanding Biden's backing of Israel's war crimes, which is part of a sordid history, a terrible tradition of U.S. foreign policy. So welcome. Thank you for being with us, Professor. And get us started on this discussion. Contextualize Biden's actions for this horrific genocide that is unfolding regardless of what the ultimate ruling are before the international criminal justice arenas. Important cases, but if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it is. Morally, this is a genocide.
Yeah, no question about it. But to get to your question about what's motivating Biden, Biden, he's had a long career in the Senate. He first came in 1973, and he was adamantly opposed to any Palestinian state for most of his Senate career. He only came around to giving lip service to a two-state solution after the Israeli government in the 1990s seemed like they might be open to something along those lines. It ended up nothing really viable, but at least they were, acknowledged, at least the previous labor-dominated governments, that the Palestinians had a right to some level of self-determination. But as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, you know, he was one of the more hardline, people. As Obama's vice president, he ran interference for Netanyahu, and worked hard to make sure that Obama, who occasionally made some pretty decent statements about Israel having to end the occupation and essentially withdraw to the pre-67 borders, you know, make sure that Obama actually didn't follow through on any of these things. Biden is of that generation, the post-World War II generation of liberals that had this really romantic attachment, you know, to Israel. You know, that, a combination of guilt from the Western failure to end the Holocaust, you know, to this, you know, this kind of almost Paul Newman and Exodus, you know, kind of idealistic view, you know, of the plucky kibbutzniks and others, you know, making the desert bloom. And, you know, this kind of, what we now, I think most people now see as a rather racist colonialist narrative. You know, but at the time it was, you know, it was deeply believed in. I mean, this is a time when you even had people like Bernie Sanders and even Noam Chomsky volunteering as young people to work on kibbutz. You know, this is a time when, Israel was a social democracy. And, you know, the contradictions and the racism and everything were there even back then. But at least you could sort of pretend that, you know, there was, you know, some progressive aspects of at least the labor Zionist, way of doing things. But he's kind of stuck in that way, even though Israel has gone way, way, way to the right, both domestically and in terms and getting more and more religiously conservative and more overtly racist and more violent. I mean, he reminds me of, you know, certain, you know, leftists who, you know, believe in socialist revolution so much that they'll, you know, deny when a revolutionary movement's, you know, actually gone authoritarian and really is doing nasty things because they're afraid that, you know, because of the lies and hypocrisy about Western imperialism, that all the criticisms, even where justifiable, might be wrong or must be wrong. And similarly, there's this kind of idealistic view around Israel. There's also the strategic aspect, you know, that Israel is, is in the words of one former Secretary of State, our unsinkable aircraft carrier. Israel can put down leftist and Islamist movements, challenging not just in Israel-Palestine, but in Jordan and Lebanon and elsewhere. It collaborates the military-industrial complexes of the two countries are closely intertwined in building new jet fighters, anti-missile defense systems. Israel's trained U.S. personnel in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations in Iraq and elsewhere. The Mossad and the CIA collaborate in intelligence gathering and covert operations. I mean, they're unlike Arab allies who could be overthrown in a coup or revolution, you know, Israel is going to be there for us. And so there's that strategic imperative. And yes, the pro-Israel lobby makes it more difficult to challenge U.S. policy. But I frankly think that even if AIPAC, et cetera, did not exist, our policy would be more or less the same. I mean, we support Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara. We supported Indonesia's occupation of East Timor. We supported Saudi Arabia just a few years ago when they were killing tens of thousands of Yemeni civilians in their terror bombing. And so, you know, in certain ways, Israel is not unique. But what we're seeing is more a manifestation of U.S. imperialism. It's not like if there is no AIPAC, suddenly the United States would be concerned about human rights, international law in the Middle East, because we've never really been concerned about human rights, international law anywhere. But, you know, as someone who's been a target of the so-called lobby, I've had talks canceled. They tried to get me fired. I've been blacklisted. I mean, I know they're their force. And again, they've made it more difficult to challenge U.S. policy. It's made it more difficult to get more Democratic allies in Congress. You know, they've helped with censorship and all these kind of things. So yeah, they're a force out there that makes it more difficult to challenge the policy. But again, we should not overlook what I think are the underlying issues, is both that ideological support for Israel and the perceptions that Israel is an important strategic asset for U.S. hegemonic interest in the greater Middle East and beyond.
Continue to develop that, because the idea that there is an altruistic or moral sensitivity that is the motivating force for the huge amounts of money and delivery of arms and the like to support and prop up the state of Israel. Indeed, the fact of the matter is that there has always been, and this really was anti-Semitic, the refusal during both of the war of the National Socialists, of Nazism. We didn't want the Jews. We didn't want the Jews. And that was true for Western Europe, most definitively true for the U.S., and were most interested in concentrating people in a particular area. And frankly, to me, the whole notion of concentrating the entire Jewish diasporic religious entity or cultural entity, if you were secular but of Jewish ancestry, together in the historic land of Palestine is in itself virulently anti-Semitic.
And, indeed, as your previous guest pointed out, Biden saying Israel is the only safe place for Jews, he's implying that as president of the United States, he doesn't have the power or the desire to protect Jews here in this country. And, you know, it's this idea, yeah, it is a kind of a ghettoization. And that's why, at least prior to the Holocaust, there was, and we're seeing it again more recently, there is widespread opposition to Zionism within the Jewish community. Israel, in many ways, does the dirty work for Western imperialism in a manner very similar to the way Jews were set up to be the moneylenders and tax collectors in medieval Europe. So they could be the scapegoats and for the people who really have the power. These reactionary Arab and Islamic movements, you know, blaming Zionism for their problems, and many of them are actually in league with Western imperialism themselves. And so, I think that, the fact that, the United States has failed to support, not just support the Palestinians, but to support the more moderate, more pragmatic forces within Israel, who seriously wanted to have a viable two-state solution back when it was possible. But the United States continually allied with the more hawkish elements. I mean, for example, Clinton's so-called compromise autonomy plan for the West Bank was less generous than what the Israelis were secretly offering in Oslo. And then when the talks following the Oslo agreement in the 90s, Biden, consistently sided with the harder line elements within the Israeli political establishment instead of pushing them to make the necessary compromise that would have made a two-state solution possible. And today, now Biden is saying, Israel's right to exist is a given. Palestine's right to exist is only dependent on what Israel can agree to, even though the Israeli government now is quite explicit that they will not allow for a Palestinian state to exist in any form whatsoever. And so Biden is deceiving us all, and so people in Congress, and they say they support a two-state solution, but they're saying we will not condition military aid to Israel to force them to do that. We will prevent the United Nations from intervening in order to do that. We even oppose nonviolent civil society efforts to push Israel to do that, such as boycotts, divestment, and sanctions. In other words, the United States is doing everything it can to prevent a viable Palestinian state from emerging alongside Israel, while claiming disingenuously that it supports it.
You've also written an article recently, U.S. attacks on the International Criminal Justice Court are a declaration of empire. And I want you to just continue that to understand that our monetary diplomatic support for Israel is part of U.S. hegemonistic imperial interests in the world community. And you certainly pointed to Morocco and various other places as an indication and our support for Morocco and that. And you've written whole books on it. Yep. So take us to that.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the United States, of course, has renounced the World Court for demanding that Israel end its violations of the Genocide Convention and pushing for unconditional military aid anyway, which makes the United States more explicitly in contributing to an ongoing genocide. Some years ago, when the World Court ruled that Israel could build a separation barrier along their internationally recognized border, but they could not build it in a serpentine fashion deep inside occupied territory, the World Court was denounced by not just President Bush, but John Kerry, who was then the Democratic nominee for president, and a huge bipartisan majority of Congress. But, you know, it's just to underscore that Israel is not unique in terms of U.S. Imperialism and hegemony. The United States has also ignored the World Court when they said that nuclear weapons are illegal. We're making more and more nuclear weapons than ever. We ignore the International Court of Justice when they said that Western Sahara had the right of self-determination. The United States, along with Israel, is the only country in the world that has formally recognized Israel's illegal annexation of that non-self-governing territory, also in violation of a whole series of UN Security Council resolutions. And, of course, the United States pulled out of the mandatory jurisdiction of the World Court way back in 1984 when it ruled unanimously, with only the U.S. judge dissenting, that it had to cease and desist its attacks on Nicaragua, its mining of the harbors, its support of the Contras, and the like. And so, again, this is I think it's important that though we not lay off in any way whatsoever in challenging U.S. support for Israel, to not fall into the trap that this is somehow exception. You know, this is very much part and parcel of U.S. imperialism and the kinds of foreign policies we have pursued elsewhere in the world that are in total contravention of most fundamental issues of international law. Now, this is not a radical argument. This is not an anti-Zionist argument. This is basically a liberal argument saying that the United States and its allies, no more or less than any other countries, are bound to provisions of international law. And so you hear Biden saying, we got to spend all these tens of billions of dollars to support Ukraine because we need to defend a rules-based international order to counter, you know, Russian aggression and their illegal annexation of Crimea and the Donbass. And yet we go support Israel and Morocco in their illegal annexations. And we block the United Nations from doing anything about it. We'll punish people who do not honor sanctions against Russia, but then we'll punish people who do want to put sanctions or boycotts or divestment in regard to Israel. So I think it's important to point out that, again, I'm not making a radical argument. I'm making a very mainstream liberal argument, and that is that international law, like domestic law, should be enforced consistently and not be, you know, based on whether you happen to be allied with this country or you see this other country as an adversary or whatever. The law is the law.
Well, we're almost at our concluding point for this program, although we will continue. Wish that we didn't have to, but we'll continue this discussion, and we also will, you know, have you back to talk about, and I do recommend your book on this, to talk about the Western Sahara War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution. That book is Western Sahara War, Nationalism, and Conflict Irresolution, since you have placed the context for our support of Israel in a general hegemonistic imperial endeavor the U.S. has. That's our foreign policy. That is who we are. That is the nature of the capitalist state. So do you want to take us out with a particular point? There's so many that we didn't get to discuss, whether it's the political cost of Biden's support for Israel's war, which are mounting, or where do you want to take us to punctuate this discussion for the moment?
You know, I think,
and we have about 60 seconds left.
Sure. Yeah, I think the most powerful tools that those of us who want to stop the slaughter ongoing in Gaza and want to support the right of Palestinians for self-determination, equality, whether it be in a viable two-state solution or a single binational state, I think we can really appeal you know, basically to these liberal values that the vast majority of Americans support. I mean, many of us personally, you know, may have values that are left of liberal, but until the majority of Americans share those, I think we can make more progress to just focusing on these liberal values that the country supposedly stands for, supposedly supports, and again, insists that they be applied to everyone. And that we, if a country as powerful as the United States, by far the most powerful country in the world, and Israel, which is by far the most powerful country in the Middle East, you know, if they aren't willing to play by the rules, no wonder you have extremist groups and terrorist groups and others figuring they can't. There's no reason they should apply by the rules either.
Well, Stephen Zunis, he's the author also of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. That was Terrorism, Courage, Press. That's 2003 book. Another important one to read. But as somebody who has long studied the Middle East and the issues of colonialism, thank you for the work you do, Professor Stephen.